to Dr. Douglas Huxley, the University of Newcastle. Dear Douglas, here are a few reminiscences of the early college days. Maybe I'm duplicating much that you already have, and maybe I've omitted much and many names that should be included, but I've tried not to cross into the territory of the Union Street booklet. Hulda Turner. Newcastle Teachers College opened in 1948, a branch of the New South Wales Education Department, with Griffith H. Duncan as its foundation principal. I arrived in its third year in 1951. At that time, and through my 17 years at the college, it was devoted exclusively to teacher training. Three types of teacher training were offered: infants, primary, small schools. In those days, before the feed-a-bus system, there were a number of small schools in the Hunter Valley, for example Bob's Farm, Salt Ash, Minmai, and a few schools out on the lake area, such as Awaba. Later, an acute shortage of high school teachers prompted the training of junior secondary teachers. English history, social studies, home economics, biology, mathematics, manual arts, art in association with the Technical College Art School, and music with the aid of the fledgling Conservatorium of Music. These were all intensive two-year courses with the occasional, mature-age students doing end-on training after a tech college or music qualification. It was an infamous arrangement. Though these courses were designed for teaching pupils in the junior or junior secondary school range, students were posted often to schools where they taught with graduates and were required to teach senior secondary classes without the status or the promise of promotion afforded graduates. Many indeed, when the opportunity offered, converted their training to degrees and postgraduate degrees. A great number of infant, primary and small school teachers did the same, and now occupy prestigious positions in the education department, colleges and universities. Then when the university was established, the college provided the training of teacher trainee graduates for the diploma in education. The calendars for those years indicate accurately the nature and scope of the academic structures of the courses. The basis of the training scheme was threefold. A, or to introduce efficient teachers into the departmental schools. B, to provide a broad base of culture as the background to teaching techniques. And C, to enable teachers to enter into the community life wherever they were posted and to participate and hopefully act as leaders. So it was, apart from the compulsory courses, that a number of cultural options were offered, and every student was required to join one option. There were art, music, needlework, drama, maths, physical education, and other options. There were too many extracurricular activities: clubs, intercollegiate visits, excursions, college camps, swimming schools, debating, and so on. It was inevitable that many options strengthened and were strengthened by sister clubs, especially in music, physical education and drama. Competitive sports, music productions, with special emphasis on Gilbert and Sullivan, drama productions grew out of these. My particular interest was drama, so I may be forgiven for giving a special mention to that. At this late time, it is hard to remember whether club or option produced this, that or the other play. But in my 17 years, there were many productions. Most staff were involved in club productions, whether they were in the drama club or the drama option or not. When I turned up at the college in February 1951, I was shocked to learn that in April, I had to mount a reenactment of the 50th anniversary of the foundation of Commonwealth as an item in a massive open-air celebration on the sports oval. One of the dignitaries in this reenactment was none other than Kevin Gosper of Olympic fame. Frantic preparations began at once. Braided gowns from scarlet cloth and wigs from cotton wool were concocted for judges. Authentic period gowns were designed and made by the needlework department under the expert guidance of Leela Whittle, and bishops and archbishops' regalia were kindly lent by Canon Single of St Peter's Anglican Church, Hamilton. A royal salute was provided for the occasion by Mr Philip Marquardt of Newcastle Boys High School. The following year, Philip was to join the college staff, and until my retirement, he and I worked very close together in the field of drama. The first drama production was in of 1951, came out of an option. It was Eugene O'Neill's Emperor Jones. This was the first Australian production of this play, and the hero emperor was none other than Douglas Huxley, later to become principal of the college in its high he status, and later deputy vice chancellor of the University of Newcastle after amalgamation in 1989. For the first of my 17 years, the college was housed in a section of the Newcastle Tech High School at Broadmeadow, now Merivale High School. And though we were cramped there, we did have a beautiful brand new hall to work in. It wasn't until we lost it that we realised how splendid it was. But we were guilty. On the night of the performance of Emperor Jones, a misfired blank tore a great jagged hole in the inner lining of the very fine stage curtains. The ammunition for this incident and the blanks were provided by the then to me unknown Philip Marquardt. In 1952, we moved into our temporary home in Union Street, Cook's Hill. Broadmeadow had at least been solid bricks and mortar, but these new temporary quarters were aluminium army huts. Narrow wooden railed-in intersecting verandas gave entrance to room after room strung out along their lengths. Altogether, there were six such blocks ingeniously enclosing two quadrangles. The verandas were open to wind, rain and all weathers, and so were the quadrangles. Assemblies of students were held here in the open air if the weather permitted it. As some kind of concession to the decencies, a small area of brick was built into the face of the administration quarters overlooking Union Street and carried the name of the institution, Newcastle Teachers College. There were no pavings, and in heavy rain, the entrance up the wooden steps was blocked off by a lake. Seagulls loved it. Perhaps it was the threat of flooding, or perhaps it was the uneven nature of what looked like flat land, that made the planners put the verandas some feet above the ground level. As the temporary converted to permanent, we began to agitate for an assembly hall. In the 11th year, one was finally built, and a very fine hall it was. No longer did we have to borrow some school hall for our productions. We had our own, and we almost lived in it till late into the nights. By day it was a gym and an assembly hall. By night it was alive with a multitude of activities: Gilbert and Sullivan devotees, drama addicts, gymnasts, exhibitors, dancers and debaters. When the college participated in Dip Ed Awards, it was made compulsory for every Dip Ed student, no matter what faculty he or she came from, to be involved in the production of a three-act play. Most memorable of these were Kay Flanagan's Medea, Colin Anderson's Emperor Jones, his second round, with stage settings designed by Tony Tripp, and a sequence of Irish plays. Then we needed a bigger and better library, and that was an interesting piece of construction. The builders were trying to find a suitable site for foundations, and all over the campus holes were dug, only to fill with water about 2 feet down. These had to be cordoned off for safety's sake. It appeared that the college was sitting on a reclaimed marshland, so they had to float a concrete inverted base, rather like an upturned concrete comb, and built the library over that. The hall, it appeared, was built on an old sand spit projecting into the marsh, and so was on sound foundations. Meanwhile, the staff battled on under these adverse conditions. Poor lecture rooms, cramped library, inadequate storage space, no temperature control, and a very, very small administrative staff. There was the well-loved Scottish Mr. Baxter, the caretaker, who would trust no one with the keys of his kingdom. Every afternoon he checked lights out and locked every one of 53 doors before finally locking the gate into Union Street. There were at first in administration only a registrar and a secretary, but in the second decade 4 secretarial staff were added, and there was 1 aide to the manual arts department and 1 to the home science department. From the beginning of the university, the college had close association with it. First, there were the conversion courses. A 2-year course was provided at the university for tech diploma graduates to convert to a university degree. The college staff and some others were asked to program a humanities strand and to lecture in it. These were the days before equal pay for the sexes, but we were assured that in this instance, equal pay would be the order of the day. It was my role to plan and coordinate the program. All went well till in the final term of the second year, the 2 women lecturers in the program were called to the university and advised that there had been an error. We should have been paid only 80% of the male fee. We were given 2 options: to pay back in a lump sum the overpayment over the 2 years, or to work the rest of the year unpaid. We had to settle, of course, for the second, but with much bitterness. Needless to say, that was the end of that particular arrangement. In my time, though we worked hard, there was a deal of social pleasure, and I remember the drama camps with a special satisfaction. On a weekend before the 3-act play was to be performed, the cast and crew went into a rehearsal camp. Our venue in the early days was the YWCA camp at Coal Point. Usually, Philip Marquardt and I conducted the camp, and other involved lecturers joined, while Leela Whittle and looked after the catering. To be included in the camp was regarded as a very special privilege. It was a happy working time, and in between there was plenty of fun. Later, we took twin cottages at Nelson's Bay. Harold Gillard, who was head of the Department of Physical Education, had a profound influence on college life. Apart from his own program and lecturing, he organised many extracurricular activities for the college. One was the intercollegiate visits: Armidale, Wagga, Sydney, Bathurst. These intercollegiate visits not only engendered sportsmanship in competitions and a lively team spirit, but also provided windows onto the way other colleges coped with their work and play. Another activity organised by Harold was the end-of-year swimming school. Every student was expected to make the best swimming grade possible, and down at Merriweather Baths, under the expert tuition of Harold, Philip Marquardt, Colin Doyle, Judy Cowley, Kath Abernethy, Helen Moller and others, a strict training program went into action. All lecturers on the staff were involved in these swimming schools in one role or another: checking attendance, marshalling, keeping watch, recording and so on. Harold also organised the college camps. While half of the students were at work in the swimming school, the other half went to the college camp. This was a very happy event in the college calendar. The 2 separate batches went into week-long residence at Richmond Youth Camp Yarramundi for a strenuous period of work and play. There were, of course, a few minor upheavals. The Cox River was attractive, the summer nights had a special appeal, and a near neighbour declared that his oranges were steadily disappearing. We got to know each other better in this week than in a whole year of lecture room contact. When I left the college in early 1967, we were still dreaming of our permanent campus and wondering if it was, after all, an unattainable pipe dream. However, in spite of our primitive campus, those who knew the Union Street experience claim that it had a camaraderie and a warm, fierce loyalty unique in similar institutions. It had to be experienced to be understood. This spirit was initiated and engendered by its foundation principal, Griff Duncan, a man of massive intellect, wide-ranging cultural interests, and infinite compassion. He put students and staff before self, and all who worked with him came to know his stature, unfaltering integrity, dedication to his college, and profound understanding. He loved his college, he was fiercely proud of it, and he fought all the way for his better world. The college motto, of course, was his, Ad Meliorem Mundum.